Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Backyard Labrish. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I'd like to welcome you this evening to our Labrish. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio, we can tell our stories to the world, and I love this platform, and I want to welcome all my listeners online and also those calling in tonight. And I am really just so inspired because I am bringing to life a brave, wonderful, remarkable woman who I don't think has gotten as much credit as she deserves. So I hope you'll all join me, and I hope everybody will join the Labrish tonight, because I am so inspired by this woman that, you know, it's amazing, just amazing. So if you're on my list, you will know that I'm going to talk about Mother Seagull. And actually, I am learning so much about her because, as I will confess to all my listeners, although I'm now loving history, I perhaps didn't have the brain for it, the time for it, or anything when I was growing up. But a lot of these stories just never grabbed me, or I was never exposed to them. So now I'm like a kid in a china shop. No, a kid in a candy shop. Not a bull in a china shop. So, again, welcome to all my listeners. And I'm going to dive right into the story. But at first, I want to really acknowledge Dr. Rebecca Tortello for just providing all of these wonderful stories for us, just me and the rest of the world, to really explore and find out. They're all on Pieces of the Past, which is posted online by the Gleaner Company. And I understand from reading that there's also a book or books about different segment of Pieces of the Past. I don't know what order it's in. There's not a lot of information. But you can actually get the publication to buy. So you can do more once I've brought it to your attention. So hopefully, you know, we will have some participation from the board tonight, because I'm going to be using Dr. Tortella's piece from the paper, as well as what I found on Wikipedia that gave me a little more details about this marvelous woman. And I'm hoping that my favorite fan from the Bronx will call in and put up his hand early in the game, because I am so worked up that I'm a little out of breath. So please join me as soon as possible. But for those who might not have known about this wonderful woman, her name is Mary Jane Seacole, and she was born Mary Grant, actually, and her father was a Scottish, I suppose, military person in Jamaica at the time. She was born in 1805, and her mother was a free black. Now, I'm not quite sure if that means she was never enslaved, because I know that there were free blacks all over the Caribbean that were never enslaved. But the documentation don't tell me this. So if I missed it or something, I hope someone will sort of help to correct me. But so she was mixed, as we know. Her father was Scottish and her mother was black, definitely from Africa, some part of Africa, but she was not a slave. All right, so I think she's well known, but I don't know if all the details that I hope to share tonight is known about her work. So I'll start off by reading from Wikipedia, and I'm asking my fan from the Bronx to come in early for me, please. But Mary Seacole was born in 1805 and died in 1881. So we're talking about long ago. And when you hear all the things this woman went through to live her passion, and, you know, that's what I try to relate the stories of the past, whether they were something that we, you know, might not be a good thing, but people overcame so much at the time to say their piece and do their thing. And I think that's what we can draw from these stories, how much alike we are, because the people who are passionate about something can get it done against all odds, because we've seen that done in our time, you know, like all the wonderful people in our lifetime that have made changes, not only to our communities, but to our nation and to the world in general. So here is a woman of color. She was looking at her picture, and they have one photograph of her that was taken. And then, of course, there are other, I don't know if there's artwork from the photograph or what, but you can actually see what she looked like. And she looks like a colored woman. So she, from Wikipedia, it says she was sometimes known as Mother Seacole, and she was a Jamaican nurse best known for her involvement in the war that was between Russia and England, you know, way back then. She set up and operated boarding houses in Panama and in Crimea to assist in her desire to treat the sick. Seacole was taught herbal medicines and remedies and folk medicine by her mother, who kept a boarding house in for European soldiers in Jamaica. So this woman learned from her mother, who was, I suppose, directly from Africa. So she came, and I don't know how she was freed. Does anybody on the board know have any more information about that? Please raise your hands, because I'm always asking for participation, because this is what a Labrish is all about. Anyway, confident that her knowledge of tropical medicine could be useful, and after hearing of poor medical provisions for wounded soldiers during the war, she traveled to London to volunteer as a nurse. relying on her experience in the Caribbean, she applied to the War Office and asked to be sent as an army assistant to the war zone. She was refused mainly because of prejudice against women's involvement in medicine at the time. And perhaps it was more than that because of who she was, you know, but it doesn't say that here. So the British government later decided to permit women to travel to the affected areas, but she was not included in the party of 38 nurses who were chosen by Florence Nightingale. Now, instead, just a minute, please. Okay, I said that already. She was refused. Now, the British, what she did was she borrowed money to make the 4,000-mile trip by herself, she alone. She distinguished herself treating battlefield wounded, often nursing wounded soldiers from both sides while under fire. I mean, whether they were on the enemy's side or on Britain's side, she didn't care. If they were hurt, she would help them. This is amazing. And we're talking, you can imagine the conditions during those times. You know, they didn't have the kind of protection that people have now against each other, you know, when they're fighting. So I just cannot even imagine. It doesn't say how old she was. Well, she was born in 1805, and this was going on in, like, in 1856. No, that is when it ended. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about her. It talked about her being honored. She was honored in her lifetime along with Florence Nightingale. But after her death, she was forgotten for almost a century. And that's why I think it is so important for every woman, especially women of color, especially of Caribbean heritage, to really know about this woman and really, really celebrate her. As a matter of fact, I really hope that they're teaching some of this woman's, you know, what she did over her lifetime to some young Caribbean children, especially girls, because this is such a wonderful story to preserve. Her tenacity, her determination, her passion, all that she went through to just live her dreams. Because of her mother, I think she was passionate about helping people. But I'm going to get to the point. It's a very long article, and it has a lot more details than what is on Pieces of the Past. Wikipedia is put together by people just editing and contributing what they know about any subject. So I'm thinking that it's put together by a lot of people. But it is quite long, so I'm trying to get the highlights and blend it in with what is on Pieces of the Past, which is a more condensed version of her whole life. But I am just really, really curious to know, if I could, the origin of her mother or how she came to be a free black, if she was enslaved then freed, or she was just a free black. But I'll take it for granted now that she was just a free black. And because there were so many British troops on the island during that time, you know, 18 whatever, or late 17 something, her mother hooked up with this Scottish soldier. And it didn't say whether they were married or anything like that. It just said that he was her father and who her mother was. So let me read now about her Kingston, Jamaica connection. She was born Mary Jane Grant in Kingston, Jamaica, the daughter of a white Scottish officer in the British Army and a free Jamaican Creole woman. Seacole's mother was a doctress, a healer who used traditional Caribbean and African herbal remedies. She ran Blundell Hall, a boarding house at number 7 East Street in Kingston, and one of the best hotels in Kingston. Now, many of the residents were disabled European soldiers and sailors, often suffering from the epidemic yellow fever. Hence, Seacole acquired her nursing skills. Now, she wrote an autobiography, and in it, she identifies her early experiments in medicine was based on imitating her mother by ministering to a doll, then progressing to pets before helping her mother to treat humans. So she actually learned on her dolly, as we would call them in Jamaica when I was a little girl, to animals. And then as she grew up, she could help her mother help people. Now, Seacole was proud of her Scottish ancestry and called herself a Creole, a term which then was commonly used in a racially neutral sense or to refer to children of white settlers. So she called herself a Creole. Now, in her autobiography, and this might be interesting, some of our readers might want to check on this, that it's titled The Wonderful Adventures of Mrs. Seacole. That is the title of it, of the her autobiography. I don't know if that is online, and if anyone knows, they can possibly tell me. It said she records her bloodline as, I am a Creole and have good Scottish blood cruising through my veins. My father was a soldier of an old Scottish family. Legally, she was classified as a mulatto, a multiracial person with limited political rights. Now, one writer who was writing about her, his name is Robinson, speculates that she may technically have been a quadroon, Quadroon. I haven't a clue what that means. Now, she emphasizes her personal vigor in her autobiography, distancing herself from the stereotype of a lazy Creole. So even then, they were thinking of people of color as being lazy. Yet she was proud of her relationship with her black American slaves, demonstrated by the few shades deeper brown upon her skin. So she was playing both sides of the fence, which I don't know if anything can be wrong with that. If you have a white father and a black mother, you have to recognize both. So she loved the color of her skin, from what I could see here, and also celebrated her strong Scottish roots. Now, at that time, the West Indies was an outpost of the British Empire in the late 18th century, which was around 1789. And a lot of troops were all over the Caribbean there. So I am assuming by that is when her mother and father hooked up. Then, you know, in 18-something, because she, 17, the late 1779 or so, because she was born in 1805. Now, she spent some years in the household of an elderly woman whom she called her kind patroness. Now, it seems like she was boarded at that time, and this is excerpts from her biography or autobiography. Before returning to her mother, So she was in the household of some person. She was treated as a member of the family and received a good education. As the educated daughter of a Scottish officer and a free black woman with a respectable business, Seacole could have held a high position in Jamaican society. So society-wise, I suppose we could say she was accepted because she was well-educated. Her mother was a free black, and her father was a Scottish officer. It doesn't say if they were married. Okay, so in about 1821, she visited London, staying for a year. And she visited relatives, and one was and also she visited the merchant Henrique's family. Now, if any of the listeners on the board are Jamaicans, they know the name Henrique's. So apparently, because they were merchants too at the time, she visited them in London. Although London had a significant population of black people, she records that a companion, a West Indian with skin darker than her own, she described it as dusky shade, was taunted by children. See, now we're talking 18-something here. Wow. Seacole herself was only a little brown, nearly white, according to Randin, who is one of the writers. She returned to London approximately a year later, bringing a large stock of West Indian pickles and preserves for sale. Her later travels would be as an unprotected woman without a chaperone or a sponsor, which was an unusual practice. Seacole returned to Jamaica in 1825. So we have her being able, apparently financially, to travel to London when she wanted to. But she was also a businesswoman. On her second trip, she knew what they would bring a price, so she went with her pickles to sell. Now, I say that woman, we would call her in today's society, as far as the Jamaican society, she at that time she was a higgler. I'm not seeing any hands on the board, so I need somebody to join the labrish because I'm putting in my own sidebar, as I call it, to jazz the story up because I see so many similarities in just behavior. It doesn't matter whether it was long ago or now. This woman was an opportunist. Not only was she passionate about what she wanted to do and focused too, she was going to get it done by any means necessary. And the story gets better. So where is my loyal listener from the Bronx? Please put up your hand, sir. Okay. Now, let me take you a little further. So now she's back in London doing her trying to sell her pickles, I suppose. Now, let me take you now to 1850. She had a half-brother. His name was Edward, and he was in Panama, which was then part of New Granada. Now, she decides that she was going to visit her brother. She returned to Jamaica in 1825. Would someone tell me how old she was then? She was born in 1905. I see a hand on the board, so let me open up the mic here because I'm a little raspy because I'm trying to fight a bug. So my listeners, please bear with me tonight. Caller from 718-379. Are you my favorite fans?
This is Lay in the Bronx.
Yes, home of the We Know Who. Help me out here. How old was she when she?
She was about 51, I think.
No, 1825. She was born in 1805.
Yes.
She was pretty young.
Yeah.
What I mean is she was pretty young when she left for London the first time.
Yes,
because
she was,
returned to Jamaica in 1825.
Yeah, I think she was a teenager the first time she went.
Right.
And
do you know anything? I see another hand. Do you know anything about her mother? How her mother came to be a free black?
Well, you know, a free black is a free black. She's not a slave.
I know, but I wondered if she was enslaved at any time. I'm just curious.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
The story that I read did not talk much about the mother, except that
mm-hmm.
she was, a person that mixed potions to tend to the sick.
Right.
And she
obviously she must have done it from her African, because of her African roots.
Well, that could be. But our main thing was to be able to provide medicines for the people in her boarding house who were ill.
Right.
And her sister, Mary, was very interested at that early age in medicine and the work that her mother was doing. So after her mother died, she took over and promoted herself as a person that did this as well as tended to the sick. So she was a nurse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's mainly her thing. And when she went to England, she was trying to walk in the footsteps of Florence Nightingale, but as you mentioned, she was rebuffed. But she had some good friends whom she had met in the establishment that her mother and herself ran in Jamaica. Very influential people. Military.
Henrique.
Not necessarily the Henriques. These are English people who spoke up for her when she went to England. So even though the people that were in league with the Florence Nightingale nurses did not give her a favorable recommendation, these people, some of them were Lord this and Lord that. She mentioned some of them in her autobiography, but blocked out the names.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She blocked out the names? Or I think she blocked out the names in the autobiography, or just blocked out because they don't want to know the public
to know
who they were?
Yes. It was anonymous. You know, anonymously, these people were pushing or maybe even financing her, because the second time she went to England, she was broke.
Right.
She, as I said, she had these people helping her out and sent her to the battlefront in the Crimea.
Right, but you know, actually, according to Wikipedia, she wasn't broke the first time. She took her own money and went to the battlefield. She was broke after all the war, and she lost everything there.
Yes,
but then she actually went to England with money.
The first time. But
but it's after the war that she got broke, according to Wikipedia.
Well,
Wikipedia says here that she actually took her own money when the Nightingale people, she tried to be part of this nursing set of people that the government was sending.
Yes,
and they did not really want her or didn't pay her any attention. she got our own money and went to the wars, to the war front.
Yes, but the, this own money was, if you read between the lines, it was donations from some of these influential people that she met in Jamaica and also in Panama.
Right. Hold on. I see 631451 would like to join the language, Labrish. So is that you, Lay? Because I thought I saw somebody's hand up too. So let me open. Yeah, both mics are open. So 631451, you're on. This is Margaret in the backyard. Who
Hi,
do
Margaret.
I have?
This is Janine from Long Island.
Hi, Janine. How are you today?
Okay, I was just buzzing in to let you know that she was 20, from 1805
to 1825. Oh,
thank
you, yes. And I'm sure, you know, that's quite a tender age. And that is why they mentioned that she was like, she didn't have a chaperone, I suppose.
Right.
That makes sense now.
Right.
That, because in those days, women did not travel, I suppose, unprotected.
Right.
Call it in those days. Yeah, so it makes sense to me. Okay, Leigh, back to you. So we know that she was pretty young when she went there. Because 20, you know, was very young in those days. So she returned to Jamaica when she was 20, actually. Right, Leigh? It says here she returned to Jamaica in 1825. So she was 20 then.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So, you know, during the time she was in Panama, well, you know, this relative of hers, the half-brother, he set up a hotel business in Panama, too. Did you read that part?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's funny because they say that travelers would ride by donkeys approximately 20 miles. This is in Panama. You know, from one place to get to the Panama Canal, I suppose, to get on a boat or to wherever they were going. So you know, they were, apparently the whole family were smart business people because the half-brother set up the hotel along the route that travelers had to pass to get to where they would get on a boat to go where they're going.
Yes, there was no canal then.
No, right. But apparently they would. It was a main route, is what
they went
I
up on a boat, and
mm-hmm.
you could only use this means of travel during the rainy season when this river was high.
Right. But let me tell you what I gathered here now. And it goes back to when a person has a passion and a purpose and they're focused. She goes there in 1851. She's in Panama, right?
Yeah.
And they're struck with cholera at that time. It reached Panama in 1849. And she was on hand there to treat the first victim who survived, which is, established her credibility and her reputation. I'm just saying the coincidence, you know, and since I'm into the whole thing about being driven, and I believe that, you know, when people are focused on what they want to do, all sorts of opportunities come their way. But I thought that was very outstanding, you know, that she was there in Panama at the time of the outbreak, and she was able to treat the very first victim who survived. So, of course, it brought her some credibility. Now, during that time, because of that, other patients came. Now you know that the woman was working from the heart because it said the rich paid, but she also treated the poor for free. Did you notice that, Leigh?
Yeah.
Now, so she didn't mind whether they were rich or poor. If they're rich, they had to pay, and if they're poor, she would also treat them. I was very touched by that. So back to you, Mr. Lay.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see some of what she used in her treatment?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, I'm sure our listeners will enjoy this. She made poultice and rubs from mustard, and she made laxatives from C-A-L-O-M-E-N. It's a mercury chloride is what it really is, and sugar of lead. I don't know what is sugars of lead. Anybody ever heard of that?
Huh. I don't know anything.
And she made them with water boiled with cinnamon. So it was mustard and this C-A-L-O-M-E-L, which is mercuric chloride, and she boiled it with cinnamon. That's how she made the poultice that she used for them. And I said, I remember, Janine, I'm sure you will remember this, how in when we were growing up, I don't know if you do too late, how, well, I know when I was, poultice, which is what they would apply to your chest and your back, or so if you had, you know, the cough or a cold or so,
right,
was very common to be used in the household.
Right, from cornmeal.
Yes, yes, yes. So I thought it was interesting when I read about that. And you know that cinnamon has been touted a lot recently as helping, being beneficial for diabetes as well as a lot of other things. And here it is in 18-something, this woman learning from her mother was using these things on these outbreaks and plagues. It's amazing. We need somebody like that in Haiti now.
Right.
I'm sure that there must be people there, you know, trying as much as they can to use some home remedies to help the people that are, you know, afflicted.
Yeah.
Now, it says here, while her preparations had moderate success, she faced little competition. The only other treatment came from a timid little dentist, this is how she described him, who was an inexperienced doctor sent by the Panamanian government and the Catholic Church. So her first, from what I gather here, her first real test that actually helped her to come into her own was this outbreak of cholera in Panama. So, you know, it's being at the right place at the right time. And you know, just seizing the opportunity to try and do some good. Now, listen to this. She performed an autopsy on an orphan child for whom she had cared, giving her decisively useful new knowledge to put to good use. Isn't that something? She performed an autopsy. This woman was gutsy. Wouldn't you say, Janine?
Yes, she sure was.
Oh, my God. I mean, when I read that, you see, there's more detailed information in these. I think it was, this is more based on our autobiography, Lay,
yeah,
than the, you know, and in the articles in the pieces of the past is.
Yeah, well, the autobiography, I couldn't spend enough time, and I'm going to go back to it because I like that kind of writing that she did, and I wondered if she was educated enough to write that way, or somebody wrote it for her.
No, she was educated. She was it said here she was she received a good education.
She received a good education, but it's her style of writing intrigued me to the point where I didn't think that she did this on her own. Maybe she had some more skilled writer helping her to do the autobiography. I don't know.
Well, I don't know how you'd find that out. But anyway, while she was in Panama, she's seeing a business opportunity. Despite the problems of disease and climate, Panama remained the favorite route between the coasts of the United States. Seeing a business opportunity, Seacole opened the British Hotel, and although this was more of a restaurant than an hotel, she seemed to have had a problem with her clientele. As it is recorded, she struggled to keep the rowdy travelers under control. At the wet season ended in 1852, and Seacole joined other traders in packing up to move to another town. She records an American giving a speech at a leaving dinner, which I suppose is a farewell dinner, in which he wished, this is him speaking, "God bless the best yellow woman he ever made," that I suppose God ever made, and asked the listeners to join with him in rejoicing that she's so many shades removed from being entirely black. He went on to say that if we could bleach her by any means, we would, and thus make her acceptable in any company as she deserves to be. Now, Seacole was incensed, and in reply, she said that she would have been just as happy to have a complexion as dark as any nigger's, and wished for the general reformation of American manners. In other words, she was telling him he was rude, even though he thought he was giving her a compliment. So here I am, I'm pointing out that she didn't take anything from anybody. She thought it was wrong for him to say that, and she rebuked him in her own way. You see what I mean, Janine?
Yes.
And that is why I am so spirited about her, because not only was she passionate about her gift, let's call it her gift, or what she wanted to do, her contribution, what she wanted to give. She was a businesswoman, and she didn't take anything from anybody.
Thanks, Doctor.
You know what I mean? Because she recognized her mother as well as her father, and she told him it didn't matter to her what skin she had.
Right.
And he was rude to be talking about that. I just love that portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Seacole also comments on the positions of responsibility taken on by escaped American slaves in Panama, in the priesthood and the army and public offices. So, Leigh, what do you gather by that? Escaped American slaves were then in the priesthood in Panama? Would you gather by that statement?
I'm not sure what that means, but the thing is that America had slaves, everywhere else had slaves, and these people apparently escaped and were making themselves useful in whatever capacity in Panama.
Her comment was that it is wonderful to see how freedom and equality elevates men. That was a quote from her.
And what the statements you were making before, there were a lot of Americans doing business in Panama at the time, and of course they were getting set to work on the engineers and people to work on the bridges,
canal.
And so they brought their prejudices down to Panama like anywhere else. And
right,
that is
right.
why she wasn't going to take anything from these Americans.
Right, right. But I thought that was quite commendable.
Yeah.
Anyway, it said that she returned to Jamaica in late 1852. She traveled home to Jamaica, but the journey was delayed and difficult as she encountered racial prejudice when trying to book onto an American ship.
There we go again.
She was forced to wait for a British boat. They wouldn't take her money. Soon after arriving home, Seacole was asked by the Jamaican medical authorities to minister to victims of a severe outbreak of yellow fever in 1853. So, Janine, by that time, how old is she? Oh, fine.
She would be about 27, 28.
Oh, isn't that marvelous? Now, she went on to organize a nursing service for the hospital at Upper Camp, about a mile from Kingston. It was composed of yellow fever, Afro-Caribbean doctresses who seemed to be largely immune to the disease. So what it's saying here is that the Afro-Caribbean people were not as prone to yellow fever as I suppose the English people were. Because, did we cover anything before, Leigh, on this outbreak of yellow fever in 1853? I've done so many shows, I can't remember.
Well,
but do you remember doing anything
on
that or hearing it mentioned before?
We may have, amongst other things, but she went smack into it because she returned to Jamaica. And
mm-hmm.
by the way, she's at this point 53.
She's 53. In
1854? 1854.
She was born in 1805.
No,
yeah.
She'd be 49, somewhere around there.
All right, 49.
But she's sort of maturing now. Okay,
oh, yeah.
So listen to this now.
And
she returned to Panama.
Don't forget, she was married in 1836, you know. She had a husband.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So listen to this. She returned to Panama in 1854 to finalize her business affairs. And 3 months later moved to a gold mining place, New Grenada Mining Company. And it was about 70 miles away. So she's still in Panama now, I gather.
Bear in mind that Panama was actually New Grenada before it was named Panama.
Panama, right, right, right.
It was
so 48. There was a gold mining place, and it had to do with the American gold rush. So,
yeah.
she moved from one area to the next to establish her business. Now, there was a superintendent there, Thomas Day, was a relative of her late husband. I think her husband died early in our marriage. Now, she had read newspaper reports of an outbreak of the war against Russia before she left Jamaica. So you can see she was well read. So she knew that the war was going on before she left to go back to Panama. And news of the escalating war reached her in Panama when she was determined to go to England to volunteer as a nurse, to experience the pomp, pride, and circumstances of glorious war, as she described it in her chapter one of her autobiography. So now here is a woman who is, listen to her description of war, pomp, pride, and circumstances of glorious war. Isn't that something? And that, I suppose, is taken from her autobiography in chapter one. Did you read that part, Leigh?
I don't think so.
But as I say, how you were saying about the description of her writing.
Yes, well,
I only
read three chapters.
I see.
There are 12 chapters.
Yeah.
So
for the people who might not know about this war, do you know anything about that war, Lee?
The Crimean War?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. Well, we had to at least be aware of the Crimean War as Catholics. It's one of those wars where it was a kind of silly war, but it was a war that brought the Allies together against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Allies being Spain, France and England and some other countries. But the real basis for this war was actually the Russians wanted to exercise more authority over the Eastern Rite Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of clashes between them and the Roman Catholics, so this expanded into a territorial war, and it was as they call it a silly kind of war, because Russia had enough men in the war, over 1 million troops, to be able to just walk over everybody, but they just didn't handle the war very well. Their generals were incompetent and so forth and so on. We don't have to go into all of those details.
Right. I see. But they said it.
But it from the religious point of view.
Right. Now, many thousands of troops from all of the countries involved were drafted to the area, and disease broke out almost immediately. Hundreds perished, mostly from cholera. Hundreds more would die waiting to be shipped out or on the voyage. Their prospects were little better when they arrived at the poorly staffed, unsanitary, and overcrowded hospitals, which were the only medical provisions for those wounded. In Britain, a letter... to the Times in October, whatever, to form a detachment of nurses. A letter was sent to form a detachment of nurses to be sent to the hospital to save lives. Interviews were quickly held, suitable candidates selected, and Nightingale left for Turkey in October of that year, which was 1854. So that's when Nightingale set out for the war zone. Now, Seacole traveled from Navy Base in Panama to England, bringing letters of recommendations from doctors in Jamaica and Panama. On arrival, she approached the War Office, asking to be sent as an army nurse, but failed to secure an interview. So when she went back there for the war, she wasn't broke, according to this. She went to apply to go as a nurse.
Now you're going to see where she becomes broke, because she had to get into what she wanted to do for the war without using her own money.
Right. So she was told to see the quartermaster general and then the medical department. In other words, they were giving her the runaround.
Yep.
She was rebuffed at each turn. Seacole was then becoming concerned about the racial prejudice that she had experienced at the hands of the Americans, which could be taking root in Britain. So what I wanted to point out here is, you remember she had been to England before, and she did not express anything about that. But once she was exposed to the Americans in Panama, she now figured that it was rubbing off, the American prejudice was taking hold in Britain. She began to realize that she would not be employed even if there was a vacancy. So they were telling her there was no vacancy for her as a nurse. Records survive which indicate that other black women suffered the same fate. Now, undaunted, She applied to the Crimea Fund, a fund raised by public subscription to support the wounded, for sponsorship to travel to the war zone. But again, she was met with refusal. So they had a fund set up that people could travel on. She finally resolved to travel by using her own resources in order to open the British hospital. Business cards were printed and sent out to a nurse announce her imminent arrival and intent to open a mess table and comfortable quarters for sick and convalescent officers. So she went there with money. Shortly afterwards, her Caribbean acquaintance, Thomas Day, arrived unexpectedly in London, and the two formed a partnership. They assembled a stock of supplies, and Seacole embarked on a Dutch steamer in January of 1855 on its maiden voyage to Constantinople. The ship, and it had been called at Malta, where she encountered a doctor who had recently left Panama, I suppose. He wrote her a letter of introduction to Nightingale. On arriving in where she was going, she took she had to take another boat across to visit Nightingale's hospital, where she encountered amongst the patients many familiar faces from the West Indies. At her meeting with Nightingale, once again, her offer for help was refused. After transferring most of our stores to the transport ship, and it had the name of the ship, and the remainder to follow by another ship, she set out on a four-day voyage to the British bridgehead of Crimea at Balaclava. I suppose that is the name of the port. Once she arrived there, lacking proper building materials, I love this part, she gathered abandoned metal and wood in her spare moments with a view to using the debris to build her hotel. She found a site for the hotel at a place she considered Spring Hill. And it tells you where it was near. It is about 3.5 miles along the main British supply road from Balaclava to the British camp near another city, within a mile of the British headquarters. Now, what I'm trying to say here, this woman had a brain on her because she didn't have the proper building material, but she figured, you know, I suppose it's a war zone. There was abandoned metal and wood, and in her spare time, she started gathering them with an intent to use them for her hotel. Remember, her mother was in the hotel business. Her brother was in the hotel business. So she figured that's going to give her a start, so they won't let her be a nurse. So she's going to do her thing. She found a site for the hotel and decided that she was going to build. So the hotel was built from the salvaged driftwood, packing cases, and iron sheets, and salvaged architectural items, glass doors and window frames from the village of Camara, using hired local labor. So she had to have money to do this. You know, yeah. Remember now, she formed a partnership with Mr. Thomas Day, whoever he was. So now she has a hotel. The new British hotel opened in March of 1855. An early visitor was Alex Sawyer, a noted French chef who had traveled to help improve the diet of the British soldiers. He recorded their meeting and described Seacole as an old dame of a jovial appearance but a few shades darker than the white lily. That's how he described her. The hotel was completed in July at a total cost of £800. I suppose that was a lot of money in those days. That was like $1 million. Listen to how it was. It included a building made of iron containing a main room with counters and shelves and storage above, an attached kitchen, two wooden sleeping huts, outhouses, we know what those were, and an enclosed stable yard. The building was stocked with provisions shipped from London and Constantinople, and local purchases from the British camp near, you know, the French camp, all near where the fighting was going on. Now, Seacole sold anything from a needle to an anchor. She sold them to army officers and visiting sightseers. How would they have sightseers in the war zone? But I suppose even then you had all sorts of people. As you say, it was a silly war, so I suppose people wanted to see it. I'm just being funny, Lee.
Yeah,
meals
I know. I know you're being funny.
Oh, meals were served at the hotel, cooked by a black cook, and the kitchen also provided outside catering. Now, they seem to be speaking of a hired cook when they're talking about the cook here. Many of Seacole's customers purchased goods on credit, causing problems later. Despite constant thefts, particularly of livestock, I suppose she had her own chickens and all of that, Seacole's establishment prospered, operating 6 days a week and closing on Sundays. She settled into a routine of opening early, serving morning coffee to passing travelers, and then dealing with callers, medical complaints, before traveling out herself to visit the war zone, to take care of people in the front lines, regardless of what side they were fighting on. Now, you tell me that is not a remarkable woman. Isn't that amazing? We're talking about 18-something. And she was like the lone, you know, woman doing something like that. Nightingale had a whole entourage of nurses. She was alone. I just think it's very amazing that she even survived. I mean, unbelievable. Now, Florence Nightingale, she was a minister of everything. She didn't know what Seacole was doing, although she did little to express her disapproval. She didn't approve, I'm sorry, but she didn't at least express it. The British Hotel charged for its services, supplied alcohol, and was open to visiting tourists as well as soldiers, leading Nightingale to later accuse Seacole of running an establishment that was little better than a brothel. Now, here's my sidebar, though. Just like a woman to be cutting down another woman, that is trying to do something to help. Isn't that something, Janine?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was her, that is how she would describe her, that her establishment was little better than a brothel.
Mm-hmm.
Some years later, corresponding to her brother-in-law, Sir Henry Vanry, in 1870, she wrote that Seacole, this is Nightingale writing, that Seacole kept, I will not call it a bad house, but something not very unlike it. That is what Nightingale wrote to her brother-in-law about Seacole. I will not call it a bad house, but something near to it. No worse. A second letter went further, stating that Seacole was a woman of bad character who kept a bad house. That time she's really pissed off, I'm sorry, mad at her. So she's hinting that she kept a bad house, which they have in parentheses, meaning a brothel. Robinson considers this change unfounded, this charge unfounded, and it was based on Nightingale's belief in her social superiority. So as I said, you know, she feels that she was not as important as she was, so she was cutting her down, as we would call it now in today's language. Nightingale sent nurses to assist at the Land Transport Hospital close to Seacole's hotel nursing establishment, and further letters records her effort to avoid association between her nurses and Seacole. In other words, she had she sent nurses to a hospital that was near to where Seacole operated, but she was telling them not to associate with her.
Well, maybe she was prejudiced.
Well, prejudiced and jealous, because
yes,
apparently, you know, she was getting results at the time that, and it's funny how much everybody knows about Florence Nightingale, and I'm sure a lot of people know about Seacole too, but not in comparison to Nightingale, and they were operating at the same time.
Same level.
So, pardon?
At the same level. She was doing these things all by herself.
Right. They say, however, a letter from John Hall, Inspector General of Hospitals, dated June 30th in 1856, records his gratitude for Seacole's assistance at the hospital. Now, this is the same hospital that Nightingale was sending nurses to. So apparently Seacole was helping at the same hospital, because this John Hall, who was the Inspector General, sent a letter of gratitude for Seacole's assistance at the hospital. So I just thought that was so interesting to see the women of those age were behaving similar to how a lot of the females are still behaving now.
And she was 51 at that.
Beg your pardon?
She was 51 at that time.
Really?
So
okay.
She was getting up in age.
Mm-hmm. She had done a great deal of good for the poor soldiers, is what he wrote. You know, this man said. Now, when Seacole faced bankruptcy after the war, Nightingale was an anonymous donor to Seacole's testimonial fund. So, in spite of all of that, secretly, she supported her. You see, because remember now, at the hotel, a lot of people were taking things on credit.
Right.
So, she was being supplied by merchants in the city, you know, where she was operating, as well as from England. She was importing things that were coming in by boat. And in the meantime, the people that didn't have any money to pay, she was giving them credit. So, anyway, it says here that she often went out to the troops, you know, right in the battlefield, selling her provisions near the British camp and attending to casualties brought out of the trenches around, you know, the port, around the area that she was. She was widely known to the British Army as Mother Seacole. Now, she often, visited, you know, another place 3.5 miles. I wonder how people got around then. I suppose by the donkeys. They mentioned about mules and donkeys. So north of the British Hospital, an overlook of valley, she would go there. They had trenches there leading to another port. So she went all along those places, wherever she could. On one occasion, attended a wounded troop under fire. She dislocated her right thumb, an injury which never ever healed entirely. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
In a dispatch written in 1855, some special correspondent of the Times wrote that she was a warm and successful physician who doctors and cures all manner of men with extraordinary success. She's always in attendance near the battlefield to aid the wounded and has earned many a poor fellow's blessings. This was written by a correspondent of the Times. His name is Russell. He also wrote that she redeemed the name of the sutler, S-U-T-L-E-R, and whatever that means, and another that she was born a Miss Nightingale and a chef seagull, and made a point of wearing brightly colored and highly conspicuous clothing, often bright blue or yellow, with ribbons in contrasting colors. In other words, she dressed happy even when she was attending the troops. She didn't want to look, you know, in those days how women used to look drab, wearing drab colors. Janine, you can relate to this. And here she is going against the grain, wearing bright ribbons tied, you know, around her, so she could cheer the men up. Isn't that something?
Yeah. She had a plan.
I just said this woman was a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, she had a plan.
Yeah. So he described her, this writer for the Times. Is the Times, are they talking about a English publication or an American publication?
Probably in English.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's amazing. I just think it's amazing. Not only was she thinking ahead, thinking outside the box when she's gathering all these scrap things to make her a hotel, but here she is also thinking that I don't need to look like the nightingales. I need to look different. I need to set myself apart. So I'm not going to try to dress like them. I'm going to do my thing. I thought that was beautiful. That really inspired me. So let me go on here because I get off on my sidebar. Did you want to add anything to what we were saying here, Lay?
No, not at all.
Okay. So they said here that she personally spared no pains to visit the fields of war and minister with her own hands such things as could comfort or alleviate the suffering of those around her, freely giving to such as could not pay. It was not about the money. This is me saying that. Apparently, it was not about the money for her, but about, you know, just doing what she loved to do. Now, in late August, Seacole was on the route to some hill for the final assault in September of 1855 when French troops led the storming, but the British were beaten back. By dawn on Sunday, the city was burning out of control, and it was clear that it had fallen. The Russians retreated to fortification to the north of the harbor. Later in the day, Seacole fulfilled a bet and became the first woman to enter Sevastopol after it fell. Oh, I love this woman. She bet someone that she would be the first woman to enter this city. Sevastopol. Lay, would you pronounce that for me, please?
Sevastopol.
Okay. Now, having obtained a pass, she toured the broken down bearings. Now, where am I now? Yeah. She broken down bearing refreshments and visiting the crowded hospitals by the dock containing thousands of dead and dying Russians. So the British and French beat the Russians off, I gathered here, right, Lay?
Yes.
Her foreign appearance led to her being stopped by French looters, but she was rescued by a passing officer. She liberated some items from the city, including, I don't know what that means, including a church bell, an altar candle, and a 3-meter-long painting of the Madonna.
Don't forget the city was on fire after the...
Right. So when they are referring to her as liberating it, is it like looting?
Not really. I mean,
no.
She was saving it from the fire. When
there is a war going on, there is spoils to the victor.
So she was gathering the spoils.
Yes.
So when it says here, her foreign appearance led to her being stopped by French looters. So they were looters.
Yep.
But she was a liberator.
Correct.
So weren't the French the winners too? But they were stealing.
Well.
Huh. Can you imagine a painting of the Madonna?
Yeah.
Huh. That is cool. And she bet somebody, didn't say who she bet, that she would be the first woman in the liberated town. Now, after the fall, hostilities continued. The business of Seacole and Day, remember that was her partner, prospered in the interim period, but the soldiers taking the opportunity to enjoy themselves in the quieter days. There were theatrical performances and horse racing events for which Seacole provided the catering. Talk about the woman being an opportunist. Yes, she was. Seacole was joined by a young relative, a 14-year-old girl, Sarah, also known as Sally. And some writer described her as the Egyptian beauty, Mrs. Seacole's daughter. But it wasn't really her daughter, I suppose, just because she was joined there in that city. The 14-year-old girl apparently came to help her with the catering.
Well, they weren't
Sarah
sure. They weren't sure about this girl. It could have been her daughter, but they had no proof of it. So,
right,
you
because
know,
I suppose there was no pregnant, no documentation or no period here where anybody said she was pregnant.
Well, they weren't going to say that because don't forget her husband died, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's our cousin.
Right. At least that's what she said. There was no evidence that it was really her daughter, or that whoever fathered this child had ever visited Jamaica at a time when she would have been nursing her ailing husband.
Yeah.
Now, one of the writers who's writing about her, Ramdin is his name, R-A-M-D-I-N, speculates that Thomas Day could have been Sarah's father, pointing to the unlikely coincidences of their meeting in Panama and then in England and their unusual business partnership in Crimea. Interesting. Now, peace talks in Paris went on in 1856, And that's when I suppose she decided to, she had to leave the town. Her hotel was full of unsalvageable provisions. New goods were arriving daily. Unsaleable, UNSA, yeah, provisions and good rules. And new goods were arriving daily, and creditors were demanding payment. That's when she ran into financial difficulties, this states yearly. She attempted to sell as much as possible before the soldiers left, because they're now going back home, peace, you know, they're negotiating peace treaty. But she was forced to auction many expensive goods for lower than expected prices to the Russians, who were returning to their homes. The evacuation of the Allied armies was formally completed at Balaclava in 1856, with sea coal in the foreground, dressed in, I think that was the wrong page I got to. But we now know that she was the last to leave that era, returning to England poorer than she left. That's when, imagine, after all the work, hard work she put in there, and apparently she made some money at some point, but because of what happened, you know, after the war and all of that, she had to auction, and I suppose the Russians were then, like perhaps they are now, bid down her prices, so a lot of the expensive things that she imported from England had to be sold for little or nothing. Huh. Now, she returned to England in poor health. In the conclusion to her autobiography, she records that she took the opportunity to visit yet other lands on her return journey. Robinson attributes this to her state requiring a roundabout trip. Oh, I suppose she had to book a trip that took her to other places. She arrived in August of 1856 and considered setting up shop with Day, who was her partner, remember, but nothing materialized. She attended a celebration dinner for 2,000 soldiers at Royal Surrey Gardens in Kensington in 1856, at which Nightingale was chief guest of honor. Reports in the Times, you're right, it's an English paper, on August 26th, and News of the World, that was the caption of the article in August, indicate that sea coal was also feted by the huge crowds, with two burly sergeants protecting her from the pressure of the crowd. People were clamoring just to see her. However, creditors who had supplied her firm during the war were also in pursuit. She was forced to move from where she was living on Tavistock Street to Covent Garden in increasingly dire financial straits. The bankruptcy court declared her bankrupt in 1856. Robertson speculates that Seacole's business problem may have been caused in part by her partner, Day, who dabbled in horse trading and may have set up as an unofficial bank cashing debts. So, in other words, there were partners, but he had this horse trading business, which one of the writers that I suppose was doing the research suspect that it was an unofficial bank that he was setting up to cash some, to I suppose divert some of the monies they were making. So in spite of all her work, apparently she was also cheated. At this time, Seagull began to wear military medals. They were mentioned in an account of her appearance in the bankruptcy court in 1856. A bust of George Kelly, based on an original by somebody else, formed around 1871, depicts her wearing four medals, three of which had been identified as the British Crimea Medal, the French Legion Medal, and a Turkish Order of Medicine Medal. So actually, she was decorated by those governments. Robinson says that one is apparently a Sardinian award, having joined British and French in supporting Turkey against Russia in the war. The Jamaica Daily Gleaner stated in her obituary on the 9th of June, 1881, that she had also received a Russian medal, but it had not been identified. However, no formal notice of her award exists in the London Gazette. I wonder why. And it seemed unlikely that Seagull was formally awarded for her actions in the war. Rather, she may have bought miniature or dress medals to display her support and affection for her sons in the army. So they're not sure whether it was awarded to her or she just bought them because, you know, she wanted to support the people she had supported.
That is a law blow because the people in the troops in the war on all sides knew of her and knew of the work that she was doing for the troops. So, you know.
Right. Well, wouldn't you wonder why it wouldn't be recorded even if she got them?
Well, they're trying to discredit that she bought them.
Well,
you
this
know,
is what
I,
one
I,
of the researchers are saying, you know, whoever he is. Here is implying that.
And in fact, they produced at a later date a portrait of her wearing these medals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how would she have those medals on in a portrait, which they wasn't surfaced for a good while after her death.
Right.
You know?
But plus, by her actions up to this point, she was not a woman that was looking for glory. She was just trying to do what she knows she could do,
yes,
which is help the wounded.
Old Florence in the background probably wouldn't promote any goodwill for her, even though she did it quietly because she knew that she was very valuable during the war.
Right. But it was obvious that the men that she helped really responded because,
oh, yeah,
you know, they talked about these verdicts.
From day one, they picked her up.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, they set up a fund for her, and many prominent people donated money.
Yeah.
And in 1857, she and Day were granted certificates discharging them from the bankruptcy. Now, we only have a few minutes left, but I got so much into this that I just want to open the board now to anyone else that might want to put in their two cents. I would just suggest that the people that are intrigued by this story really go to Pieces of the Past to get, you know, some more information, or Wikipedia, because Wikipedia really, really had a lot of information. We have a minute left. So I wanted to mention here that they had a fundraising activity that a lot of musicians, you know, as I was reading this, I thought about, you know, Michael Jackson when he had that fundraising, he wrote that song. You know, it seems like musicians are always sort of sensitive to people who have done some good or a cause or something because, you know, they're artists at heart. But I was struck here that it said that, you know, a lot of musicians donated and artists donated their time and to perform. You know, 11 military bands and orchestra conducted. We only have a few seconds, and so we might sign off the ear in terms of recording. But for the people on board and online, we will still be streaming, so you'll still be able to hear my little sidebars on the rest of the story. But I do encourage you to go and check it out if you love history, if you love people of passion, and if you love the lessons we can learn from some of these stories about different individuals that I've just been mentoring, featuring people with a Jamaican background, because that's what we celebrate here in the backyard. The backyard is here to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And I got so into the story, I don't even think I said that twice tonight. So I'm hoping that by the time it gets recorded, people will know what they were listening to. But, I mean, this has been quite an inspiring story for me because it had so many twists and turns. Because now, Leigh, did you know that there were all these people got together, you know, to form this sequel fund? They had a grand military festival,
yeah.
And it was held at Royal Surrey Gardens, wherever that is. Would that be in London? Do you know?
Well, Surrey Gardens is outside of London, yes.
Yeah, it was a very successful event, and it was supported by military men, including a major general who was Lord Rokeby. Who had commanded the 1st Division in the war. And, you know, quite some other Lord person was there. And over 1,000 artists performed, including 11 military bands and an orchestra that was conducted by a French conductor. Who was attended, and it was attended by a crowd of 40,000 people. The 1 shilling entrance charge was for the first night, and half of the Tuesday performance. The 1 shilling entrance charge quintupled?
Quintupled.
What does that mean, Leigh?
Quintupled, five times over.
One shilling entrance charge for the first night. Oh, so by Tuesday, it went up to 5 shillings.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
However, listen to this now. However, production costs had been high, and the Royal Surrey Garden Company was itself having financial problems. It became insolvent immediately after the festival, and as a result, Seacole only received £57.
Oh,
one quarter of the profit from the event. When eventually the financial affairs of the ruined company were resolved in March of 1858, the Indian mutiny was over. I'm telling you, this woman had some life. Isn't that something? In other words, they made money, but she didn't get much of it. Can you imagine 40,000 people attended?
Yep.
I think that is amazing. I think that is just a testament of when people really follow their passion, what can materialize from it. Because when this woman took off on the ship to go to the war zone, I mean, she just wanted to go there to help. She wasn't planning to go there and start a hotel. She had to do that because they wouldn't let her in. But my point is, look what happened because she never gave up. She never gave up. She just kept on keeping on. And there are so many lessons to learn from all of these people who made a difference in the world that we can draw from today, and young people hopefully can draw from today. And I really hope that if they're not yet doing it, that the Jamaica curriculum, even at a high school level or even before, will feature some of these people that were, you know, from Jamaica that did such magnificent things all over the world. I really, really hope that they'll be given some reference and credibility and really help young people to be proud of who they are and what they can do, not just for themselves, but for the rest of the world. And with that said, I'm going to ask any other callers who might want to say something in support of what we are referring to here. I see we have several callers on the board. If you'd like to join the Labrish, we're not being recorded right now, but we're streaming. We're still available to the people on the board and I think online. So if you want to join the Labrish, just hit 1 on your telephone, and I'll be happy to open up the mic to you. And I know I've been mumbling a lot, but I have been really just carried away to a different dimension with this wonderful, fantastic, dynamic woman of color. So, Janine, do you have any footnotes before we sign off?
No, it's just really something to hear. You know, she was sure gifted in whatever she was doing, and she really had a way of planning stuff and getting things done. She was really remarkable, you know.
Right.
Even
well,
when there were obstacles in her way, she found a way to, you know.
She worked around them, you know, and
yeah.
As I said, in all of the stories we've done, you know, there's always people coming up to the plate and overcoming obstacles. So one of the lessons I learned, you know, it don't matter what period you live in, there's going to be obstacles.
It's
I'm sure
that she learned a lot from her mom, too, you know. You
right.
have to give the mom credit.
And she used it.
Yes.
But another thing that stood out to me is that it seems like she was very young,
mm-hmm.
she knew what her passion was.
Yeah,
because she was taking care of her dolls,
yes,
then animals,
yes.
then she was helping her mother with the patients.
Right.
So you know, a lot of times that helps when early in life the kids just know what they want to do. They just know it.
Right.
You know, it just comes. But as I said, there was just so many marvelous stories from this one story. You know, tenacity, just being out there, even when she went to England without a chaperone, she was young the first time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But this woman didn't make anything stand in her way of getting what she wants done. I was just curious. I didn't see it anywhere. I don't know if you did, Lay, who she bet that she would be the first woman in the city. Did you see that information anywhere?
No.
And it didn't mention much how effective Day was, you know, her partner in all of this. What, in the footnote, we noticed that he had a horse racing business or whatever. But anyhow, I just wanted to mention, I know I'm not recorded, but I just want to mention how important it is for people to really leave their stories and to write their stories so other people don't have to write it for them.
Right.
You know, she was smart enough to do that, and there were a lot of information that I suppose she just gave reference to, and other writers that are doing the research are trying to put different meanings or twists to them, just like I try to put some twists to what I read. But I think it's just fascinating because the basic lessons are there that, you know, it don't matter whether what period of time, I think people have more opportunities now. We have a lot more opportunities now to make our marks. And we live in a period where the technology alone that we experience, we're coming from, you know, little or none to what we have now. So I just encourage people to embrace it and to really, really leave a legacy of some kind, either through somebody else by teaching them something that you know, or taking part in doing something that will be teaching on the next generation or sharing with the next generation. Because, you know, in doing so, we're leaving a little of ourselves. And to me, that makes us immortal. So with that said, I want to thank you, Mr. Lay, for being such a loyal fan and helping me out each week.
Well,
I want to thank you, Ms. Janine, for being verbal and letting me know you are there.
You're welcome.
I want to thank all the listeners on the board for coming by. And I know sometimes I'm babbling, but and I'm not going to make any excuses for it, but sometimes there's a reason. And also the listeners listening online, and I want to encourage you to share the links with your friends that might have an interest in any of the shows we do. They're all archived, and you can listen to them individually and just copy and paste the link and send it to whoever you want to. We ask you to share the information with your friends so we can have more. We will always have more chairs available in the backyard when we lavish. Right, Janine?
Right.
Chairs are always available.
Yeah.
So we invite you to come often and bring a friend along with you. So with that said, I am going to say goodnight. Mr. Lay, any parting words?
Yeah, it might well be noted that her autobiography was published at first in 1857, republished in the UK in 1984, and published in the United States 1988.
Wow.
And she was voted the greatest Black Briton in 2004, so she is very much alive.
Wow.
I was fascinated by her writings. You can find them on the website. You know, if you just punch in Mary Seacole, and you enjoy some of her writings as I did.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks for that information. And for the people who might not have the time or like to read, you can always come to the backyard. And there are lots of stories that we have in our archives. And we will continue to come up with stories that we hope you will enjoy as much as we do. And with that said, I want to thank everyone again. And as I always say, make it a great week. See you next week. Good night.
Good night. God bless.
Thank you. Same to you. Good night, Mr. Lay.
Good night.
Good night to all our callers. Come back next week. We'll have another story. Bye-bye.
Bye.